Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Vikram Chandra, whose book is titled Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. Vikram Chandra is a novelist. He's written three novels, Red Earth and Pouring Rain, Love and Longing in Bombay, and Sacred Games several years ago, which I interviewed you for. This is a full-length essay concerning coding, programming, and I guess Indian philosophy, which is kind of an interesting mix. And there are different ways to go about this. But before we start on the content of the book and some of the details, I understand this began because your wife, novelist Melanie Abrams, asked you about the ethnography of programming, and you decided to explain it to her, and this book's the outcome?
She's always been kind of mystified by my interest in computers and my general geekiness, because she's not that way at all. So I've been thinking about this for years, about trying to write what I thought would be a short article about the subcultures of programming for the non-IT person, for the civilian. And then finally, two or three years ago, I hit a level in my fiction writing, so I thought, well, this is a good time to do that. And from that, the book came.
Did you know at that point the directions you were going to take?
I was mainly going to talk about the subcultures of programming in the sense of what are the mythologies that have been constructed, who are the famous figures, what are the values that people live by. And then I was trying to find an entrance into the book, and it finally occurred to me that aesthetics would be one interesting way to actually get into the book, because programmers, and people outside programming might not know this, think a lot about beauty, about expressivity, about clarity in the code they write. And I spend my life thinking about another kind of beauty and clarity in fiction. So I thought that would be an interesting way to look at it. And then that generally then opened out into the sort of vast swaths of history that I cover in the book.
Well, you talk at the beginning of the book about the relation of art to programming, and I'm reminded of one of my best friends who lives in New York, who is a phenomenal guitarist, yet at the same time he's also a top-level programmer.
Right.
And at the present time he's in his 60s, and virtually everyone around him where he works is at least 30 to 40 years younger.
Right. So in America particularly, this fairly generalized belief among programmers that music and programming are somehow related, that people who have talent in one area tend to have talent in the other. And I can see why, because there's a similar emphasis on clarity, on architectural beauty, so that the different pieces of a composition have to make some sort of resonance with other pieces. And the same kind of thing happens in coding, where the architecture itself has to reveal intent. It seems to me kind of culturally based somehow, because at least in India, in programming circles and in music circles, I haven't heard of the same connection. Although I do know some Indian programmers who are very passionate listeners and so forth.
But nobody who's creative in the same way. It just doesn't...
Yeah, I don't think there is this equivalence made between musical ability and programming.
Well, there's a lot of comment in Geek Sublime about the relationship of poetry to coding, yet you've said in interviews that ultimately they're different. Art and code are different.
Right. That's where the investigation that I began finally took me, as I was trying to think about this often stated belief that coding is art. Right, so that there's actually WordPress is a very popular blogging platform, and at the bottom of their site, they actually have a little slug that it says, "Code is poetry." Right, so there's a very sort of straightforward equivalence being made there. So I started to think about that. That's where the Indian pre-modern Indian aesthetic philosophers became very useful, because they thought a lot about this. The tradition of Indian linguistics is very old and goes back almost 4,000 years. And they did some very sophisticated work early on in thinking about language. And one of the incredible things that came out of this intellectual ferment was the Sanskrit language itself, which was and is a spoken language, but also in 500 BCE was codified by a grammar written by a name named Panini. And that grammar is not a paradigmatic grammar in the way that we generally think about grammars. That is to say, the grammar that I learned English from in second grade showed me verb declensions, and then I had to learn those by heart and then remember those as examples and then imitate those. Panini's grammar is actually a rule set. A rule set. It's a set of very economically expressed rules, 3,976 of them. It's very compressed. You can print the whole thing out in about 40 pages of normal-sized text.
So this is a set of rules that manipulate what?
Phonemes and morphemes. So in other words, what you have along with the rule set is a set of verb roots and a set of nominal stems. So for instance, the first verb root in the list of verb roots is bu, which means being, right? Which is a good place to start. So what you do when you want to use a word referring to being, you run that verb root through this series of rules. And what that does is it changes the string, to speak in modern computer terms. It augments it. It affixes things to it. It prefixes things to it. And finally, what pops out at the end is a word ready for use. And you can similarly generate sentences by running it through this rule set.
Would that mean that there are, in some respects, either an infinite number of verbs to be because you're taking 3976 rules and then multiplying them over and over with each other?
Indeed, indeed. So the rules can call each other recursively. There's rules by which define how other rules work. Certain rules block other rules. In other words, there's a set of very simple rules that produce an infinite amount of language computation.
That sounds exactly like computer programming.
Indeed. And it's sometimes been compared to the Turing machine. And that's the amazing connection, is that the grammar has a very interesting career both within India and outside of it. So it gets discovered by that first flush of Orientalist research in India in the 18th and 19th centuries. It gets taken up first by the Germans and then translated into English. And then it becomes one of the great influences of modern linguistic science. So Ferdinand de Saussure, who, of course, we nowadays regard as the father of structural linguistics, was a Sanskrit professor. Leonard Bloomfield, who set the direction of a lot of American linguistics in the 20th century, was also a Sanskrit professor. Noam Chomsky, with his generative linguistics, often spoke of his debt to Panini. So when in the mid-40s and 50s, when computer programmers started trying to get away from zeros and ones and wanted to create new formal languages through which they could tell machines to do things, they looked for inspiration or for ideas to modern linguistic science, which in turn was based on Panini.
In essence, the computer language of today is kind of the distant grandnephew
yes.
of Sanskrit.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. And Sanskrit, interestingly enough, because of the incredible influence of this language, becomes a formal language in the sense that, unlike other spoken languages, it doesn't drift across the centuries. So that if you had a pundit today in modern Varanasi write a letter in grammatically correct Sanskrit, you could time machine it back 2,000 years, and they would be able to read it.
Because the rules are that strict.
They're very strict.
Have to be that strict if you've got this kind of complexity.
Indeed, indeed.
And so the rules are equally strict in computers because ultimately it breaks down to an on-off switch.
Exactly. And you cannot speak ambiguously to a computer. You have to have extreme clarity, not just of the semantics, but of the syntax itself.
Vikram Chandra, let's go into a little bit the explanation of what exactly happens in a computer, because this part of it is something that a lot of programmers don't get. They
right.
don't understand. Now, you spend about 30 or 40 pages in Geek Sublime doing that. You think you could do it in like 3 minutes?
It's hard. It's hard because it's so counterintuitive. And that's precisely one of the reasons that I wanted to do it. Because I'd noticed that in a lot of popular accounts of computing written for the general reader, they'll explain some of the ways in which programming works, and then they'll say, well, it gets converted into zeros and ones, and then there's these things called logic gates, and mysteriously, somehow magically, computation emerges out of this. So I wanted very much to avoid that, particularly in reference to Melanie. Once I had myself figured out how all of this worked, to try and explain to her, there's a very elegant and simple mechanical process going on at the bottom of this that is so, it's just amazing, because you don't need electricity and silicon to build this. You can build it out of water and pipes. You can build it out of dowels and wood.
The way I see it, right, you've got a single on-off switch, and then you've got two on-off switches, and then you've got two and two and two and two.
Right.
And each step, the zeros and ones, if you want to call off zero and one, they get bigger and bigger, right. And then at some point you need a set of rules, and that's where Boolean logic comes in?
Right, exactly. In the mid-19th century, we have George Boole, and he takes symbolic algebra and applies it to logic. In other words, when you learn in your kindergarten math class, you can add these two numbers with this function in between called plus. This is the result you get. So what Boole does is he applies the same sort of thing to inputs of true and false. He refers to certain functions like conjunction or negation, which are the equivalents of plus and minus for use in algebra. And he works out an entire system by which you can have logical inputs and logical outputs. When you combine that algebra with the ability to represent numbers not just in decimal, which is to say using the digits 0 through 9, you can also represent numbers in binary, which is to say only using zeros and ones. When you combine those two, you have a computation machine, which you can build out of these very, very simple single-step organisms, if you want to call them that, that feed into each other, and then you build larger and larger components, and finally you get this machine that can format your epic novel in a second. It's incredible, but that's actually what happens.
Going back to the first computers, the ENIAC, as you explain in Geek Sublime, what you had were people walking over and flipping switches in right. The same way that it's done automatically inside a single chip.
Exactly, right. They were flipping switches, and they were moving these patch cords, which looked like those telephone cords from old-fashioned switchboards. That was the programming. It took them several days to set up the simplest of programs, and it took several more days to debug the program to see whether it was working or not. And then when you wanted to solve a new problem, you ripped out all the patch cords and reset the switches and then did it all over again.
And eventually they got more and more complex. How did you find out that the 1985 supercomputer is less powerful than the iPhone you've got in your pocket?
Right. There's a lot of interesting research been done on that. I believe that particular fact came from an article by a computer scientist named Jack Gansley, who points this out, that we're all walking around with supercomputers in our pocket. And supercomputers of the type that you could break the Enigma code, you could make nuclear bombs, design nuclear bombs on these things. So the exponential increase in hardware power over the last half century is something astonishing. It doesn't quite make sense to the human mind if you actually think about it, try to think about it.
You make a point in discussing ENIAC, that very first computer, that at that point people would flip switches, and if something went wrong, there was no way to turn it off. And so one of the women there, because the people flipping the switches were mostly women, said, wait, you need an off switch. You need to stop the operation.
Right, right. That's the amazing, unbelievable thing, that at that point people didn't actually understand that programming was a very hard thing to do. The idea was that the intellectual effort was mostly in the conceptualization of the data structures and the algorithms, which were done mostly at that time by the male planners, the scientists who were working on the machine. And then they would hand off these plans, as it were, to the coders, who were thought of as secretarial stuff, more or less. They engaged in a mechanical process like typing, and they would kind of translate those data structures and algorithms into the language of the machine. That's when Betty Holberton, who's one of those pioneering programmers, has to point out to the planners that, look, it doesn't always work. It's very hard what we're doing. You've got to give us a way to call a halt to it in the middle, which they kind of reluctantly do because they still can't believe it's that hard.
When we were younger, people would say to us, oh, that's your mistake. The computers don't make mistakes. But as it turns out, the more complex a program is, the more chances that one of those little switches, being the language of code translated through umpteen phases to 0 and 1, if one of those zeros is a 1, it throws everything off, and what you have, in fact, is a computer that doesn't work right, or a program that doesn't work right and has a bug, right?
Exactly. I should emphasize this. All programs have bugs, or at least potential bugs. The programs that we use in our everyday life that, in a sense, run our world today, these algorithms turned into the language of machines, are incredibly complex. Just for example, one of the 2008 distributions of an operating system named Linux comprises 200 million lines of code. in that incredible universe, forests of code, there are going to be things that act unpredictably in relation to each other. And we can't ever predict, sitting down at your computer when you're doing the programming, how users will use it, the hardware or software that will be interacting with your specific program, which is why now, you know, in the last couple of years, we've had these constant strings of scandals and terrifying reports of, well, somebody's leaked all your secret passwords on a bank website, and now some mafia on the other side of the world has access to your most cherished information. The reason that is happening is that there's always these unpredictable holes, if you want to think of it that way, or bugs where things act unpredictably, and these people exploit those chinks in the armor, as it were. There are some programs which have existed, say, for the last 20 or 30 years. Hundreds of programmers might have worked on the code, patching, adding features, trying to fix bugs over the decades on that. So you finally, in some instances, end up with systems that are working, but nobody completely understands how they work. And therefore, nobody completely understands how to fix them.
If we were to go back to, say, Microsoft Word 1999 or something like that, would that be a more bug-free system at this point than Microsoft Word 2014?
That's a good question. I'm not sure, because what happens is there's a sort of two-sided process that's going on. One is that there's constant bug fixing going on, right? So every time somebody reports a problem, you would hope that it gets put into a system, and at some point some team of programmers gets assigned to chase that thing down and understand it and fix it. So programs usually, or at least the more important ones, are being improved all the time, right? But the trouble also is that as you do that, you might introduce new bugs at the same time as you're fixing old ones. And as you're trying to add new features, you're building the next version of the program, you might introduce new ones as well. So it's like a constantly changing organism in which it's very hard to predict whether this year's version is better than the last year's version. You would hope so, but it's not always true.
A friend of mine several years ago said one of the problems with computers is that the latest version of something is usually too buggy to really release, and you should really use the version from 2 years before, but maybe that doesn't work.
Well, that's the general sort of hardened computer veterans' advice, is never be the first pioneers to use a program. Wait until version 3.3 or 4 to use version 3, because by that time, the major bugs you have been chased on.
Vikram Chandra, let's get away from the computer geek thing, and let's move into another area, because you cover several areas in Geek Sublime, one of which is the macho nature of Silicon Valley and the politics of Silicon Valley. So in your mind, how did that come into the essay? At what point did you realize that you wanted to delve into that? Was it when you found out the women were the programmers in ENIAC?
There's a kind of shadowy, obscured knowledge of that in the computing world in general. And it goes even further back than the ENIAC. Charles Babbage's major collaborator in the 19th century on the first machines that he worked on was Ada Lovelace, Lord Byron's daughter, who was actually the first person who wrote an algorithm designed for execution by a machine, which was a little program that she wrote to derive Bernoulli numbers. All along, there have been women who've been pioneers. Many people will have heard of Grace Hopper, Admiral Grace Hopper, who wrote the first compiler and was part of the creation of the language COBOL. What's interesting about the gendering of computation, especially in the United States, is that once people discover that it's a very valuable skill and that it's hard to find people who can do it well, it needs to be professionalized. Over the 60s and 70s, it gets made into something that is a white-collar job as opposed to a kind of secretarial mechanical service. And as that happens, it gets masculinized. Certain ideas of who can be involved in this get attached to the craft itself. What was interesting also to me is to notice that in other parts of the world, this doesn't happen in the same way. So, for instance, in India, the proportion of programmers who are women is actually higher than it is in the United States, which, given all the other indexes by which we usually measure women's health, access to political power, professional abilities, is anomalous. There's been a lot of scholarly interest in this phenomenon over the last couple of decades, and a lot of those sociologists and anthropologists and so on who've looked into it have reported in their research that computing is not gendered in the same way. So although India is a very gendered culture in many ways, IT is thought of as a region that is accessible to both men and women equally.
Do you think this is starting to change in America?
I think there's been a lot of awareness of the kind of unconscious almost gendering of computing as male over the last few years. And there's been controversy after controversy in Silicon Valley, especially, about the way that women are treated, that the way that the assumptions are made about who should be doing this kind of work.
We see that in the TV show Silicon Valley.
Indeed, yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, I've only seen a couple of episodes of it, but I did notice that there's one woman in the first couple of episodes, and she is not one of the people who are actually the programmers or the venture capitalists, but she's a kind of caretaker, a human resources person.
You also go a little bit, Vikram Chandra, into the area of libertarianism and the politics of Silicon Valley, kind of leftist libertarianism. I kept thinking about Google and Facebook subscribing to ALEC. ALEC is the right-wing group that writes all of the legislation.
Right.
Did that make sense to you?
The prevailing ideology in the industry is a strange combination of social openness. So in other words, it's not rightist at all in those terms, but also this belief in the efficacy of a completely free market. This idea that computation has already changed the world, and if we were completely left to our own devices without any undue governmental interference, we would fix the rest of the problems of the world as well. It's very obvious that, of course, this belief in this mythical free market is completely also, in a sense, religious. It's fundamentalist, because there is no such thing as a completely free market, as has been demonstrated in the industry recently when we discover that in regard to the salaries paid to engineers in Silicon Valley, the free hand of the market was very firmly attached to the black-clad arm of Steve Jobs, who was doing a kind of cartel fixing behind the scenes and making sure that the big companies like eBay and Google and Apple didn't try and compete. So again, the free market is only as free as the industry might want it to be. I guess one shouldn't be surprised, right? I'm from India, and we were the early victims of the corporate impulse, in that the first truly modern corporation, the British East India Company, did their thing in India and also managed to market plundering. It was really robbery on a huge scale for 200 years as a kind of benefit to the subcontinent, right? So this amazing sort of economic steamrolling, which is then marketed as improving the world, is something that we shouldn't at all be surprised by anymore.
How do you think the Indian computer industry is affected all these years later by 200 years of colonialism? Is it?
I think the economy in general, shattered by the colonial presence, is still, in a sense, recovery from that. India in 1650 had something to the order of 23% of the world's manufacturing being done on the subcontinent. By the time the British leave in 1947, we're down to 4%. So the poverty and the kind of colonial trauma that's associated with all of that, I think, is still very much with us, and we're still trying to sort it out, even in barely economic terms. I think one of the great achievements of the Indian state has been the maintenance of democracy in spite of all of this. It's very hard to separate the past from the present, at least in those terms.
In working on Geek Sublime, you move into the area of Indian history and Indian aesthetics, eventually reaching a place, which I tend to agree with, which is that the more you try to define aesthetics, what's good and what's bad, the more you fail, because it leaves out something that's coming from the heart.
Right. Although I wouldn't quite define it as ineffable. What was interesting about those pre-modern Indian aesthetic theoreticians was that they were working within this very strong tradition of linguistic science, from the same place that Paninini and a lot of Paninini's successors came from. So what they did was to try and understand, why does certain kind of language affect us in certain ways? And they came up with very interesting answers. The early theories were all formalist. So in other words, language is made beautiful by simile and metaphor. style, which is to say the sound of the language, the consistency of it, the speed of it as it moves across the palate, all of that also contributes to its aesthetic effect on the listener. But then in the 8th and 9th and 10th centuries, there's some very interesting work done where they start to talk about dhvani, which literally means reverberation or resonance. The closest English translation would be implicature, which is to say poetry speaks by not speaking, right? So that if you've ever taken a creative writing course, probably in lesson one or two, they will tell you show, don't tell. So the not telling part of it is what makes literary language beautiful. You imply, you suggest, you resonate language in a certain way that then has an effect of pleasure upon the reader. And that pleasure, as you say, is very individual because you might not be moved by something that I find completely transcendentally beautiful. And so the transaction between the text and the reader is the unpredictable part. But what the writer does is set up the text in the best way that he or she knows how to make that resonance possible.
When the British came along, how long did it take for Indian culture to adapt and realize that they were looking at people who had a completely different perspective and could no longer see what they were seeing? Did they ever get that cultural fluidity exists?
Yeah, no, I think people actually understood that in the pre-modern world perfectly well. There's been some very interesting work done over the last couple of decades about the exchanges between classical Greece and classical India in terms of philosophy and ideas. And that exchange was very active, getting only more so once you had Rome rise as a power and all the trade that went on across the Arabian Sea. All of that has been going on for centuries. I think what happens with the onset of British colonialism, which is different than anything that has happened before, is that they come in with this idea of civilizational superiority. And they set up this narrative wherein certain models of Western thought and political organization are the only sophisticated human ways to exist. So there's that encounter, but that encounter is backed up by guns and economy, right? So that makes a huge difference in that the Indian scholastic system, which goes back thousands of years, is suddenly removed from the sphere, as it were, and they start setting up these new universities, which then feed the new political systems and the new economic systems. So if you're an Indian pundit in the mid-18th century, suddenly you find that your patron, who might have been, you know, a king or a court, suddenly ceases to exist. And what choice do your children have? Well, they have to go to these British-run universities, right? And I think that encounter becomes the truly, I suppose you could call it, damaging one, in that the ideologies and the politics produced in those universities is completely in line with the colonial mission and the exploitive economic mission. And I suppose we're still trying to engage with that and understand it. I don't think there's any going back to some mythical paradise of, you know, before colonialism. But I think what is going on across the world is some sort of rethinking of those ideologies.
In reading Geek Sublime, I finally understood Bollywood singing and dancing because it's a part of a syntax. It has nothing to do with a musical per se.
Indeed. So, and I think this is what is very confusing to the Western viewer who happens upon Bollywood film on late night television, is that you have a gritty war movie, right? And people are getting blown up and somebody gets shot and then they all sit down and look very sad and they start singing, right? Which doesn't make sense in the syntax of a Hollywood musical, which is supposed to be out of a different kind of universe altogether. Again, the vocabulary of Indian art comes from a very different tradition which has developed its own system of aesthetics, its own language, and which goes back thousands of years. And film is one of the areas in which that tradition still keeps expressing itself.
Vikram Chandra, explain Mortz and Einstein.
The division of Microsoft that is responsible for producing programming tools. In other words, programmers use other programs to write programs. And some of these are very complex, very expensive, and very big. Within that division, they have these personas they've set up to enable them to construct these tools efficiently and market them correctly. So they have these three kinds of people who they imagine as programmers. One is Einstein. And Einstein is a computer scientist, he or she understands the machine down to the very last bit and byte. They understand how the hardware works. There's Elvis. Elvis is not quite as intimate with the machine as perhaps Einstein is, but he or she still has been trained formally in the use of programming. And then finally, there is Mort. And Mort is somebody like me, right? I picked up programming while I was doing something else. I never had any formal training, but I discovered I could use machines to do useful things, and then I discovered somebody would pay me to do this, which was amazing. So Mort is the average programmer who really is only using the machine as a means of making money. She's not interested in really understanding how it works, and in some sense, Mort makes terrible programs. Right, Mort produces buggy programs because she's interested or he's interested in efficiency, right? You tell Mort to do something and he'll slap together something and have it working by tomorrow morning, which doesn't mean that it's any good. You could find out that it's the most terrible thing that's ever written when you try and fix it next month, but it works. Right?
I keep thinking that at one time you were Mort and also you were Hemingway, meaning that you were a writer and you were a coder. Do you need both sides of you? I mean, should you be doing coding in order to kind of nourish the Hemingway?
It certainly feels like that to me, or at least it feels like after a day of writing fiction, I turn to programming with a sense of relief because it indulges a completely different part of my body and brain. And best of all, when I write programs, I can test them to see whether they work or not. So because what you do when you write programs is break down the larger type of functionality into very small pieces, and then you start constructing those small pieces and assembling them. So each of the small pieces can work independently, and you try and test to see if it works. The difference between that and writing 10 sentences of literary fiction in a day is that you never know whether those sentences work or not. And so for me, programming, I suppose, fills the same space as going into the garage and building model train sets. That's for somebody else.
The thing about programming is that it becomes clear there's no blame involved. Either something works or it doesn't. Whereas in aesthetics, we do tend to blame. We say, this is good, this is bad. We don't say, oh, this doesn't work. And maybe if we applied that idea of working and not working, we can get past a lot of issues.
Well, I don't think that's really possible. And I should also point out that programmers are terrifically quick to blame. They will fiercely say, well, this might be working, but it's so horrible and ugly. It's the worst thing that ever existed, and it should cease to exist immediately. I can do it better, and I'm going to now show you how to do it better.
Vikram Chandra, in a class you recently said that science is a kind of ideology. At the same time, we're living in a technological world where it seems that fanatical religion is taking over as well. Do you think those are connected in any way?
Yes, I do think so. And I mean science is ideological in several ways. One is that despite the claims to transparency, rationality, what we do know about the actual practice of science is that it's always ideologically shaped, it's politically run, and that even the everyday working of scientists in labs is shaped by who has the funding, who doesn't, who is charismatic, who is not, who has access to power and who is not. So just like any other activity, it is not something that happens independently of the stickiness, the messiness of life in general. And that's definitely one of the things that I wanted to get at in the book is that IT, programming, computation, all of this doesn't happen freely of ideology as well. And neither does aesthetics. Aesthetics is always rooted in certain cultural realities, in political systems, in economic systems. And then I think a lot of what we see today as religious fanaticism, and we often, strangely enough, use the word medieval to refer to all of this, is not medieval at all. It's extraordinarily modern. Again, I think it's very much a simplification to say that these people are stuck. I often hear this line, these people are stuck in the 10th century. No, they're not stuck. They're actually a very much part of the modern universe, and they have been produced by modernity as much as you or I have. So I think this dialogue that we use, this language that we attach to certain activities, is a way of othering. It's a way of actually pretending that they are unlike us. If anything, I think one of the effects of the sort of pre-modern parts of Geek Sublime, I hope, should be to demonstrate that, like the pre-modern Indian philosophers, like Panini, our ancestors were working at a very high level of intellectual sophistication. This whole dialogue of the past and the present, the primitive and the modern, seems to me shot through with problems.
Well, also, of course, when Al-Qaeda is using Google.
Yes, indeed. You know. Indeed. And Twitter, right? And sending out daily social media reports about what we did today. It's incredible to think of that in any way as medieval. It's not.
I keep coming back to something at the very beginning of the book and our discussion, which is that on some level we don't understand technology, and on that level it does become magic. And that when you're talking about medieval, you're talking about people who believe in magic.
Exactly. And that we trust in some ways our systems in that same magical way, right? So that, the scientist in the lab coat becomes a kind of figure of authority, a priest who can rescue us from our demons, as it were. There are certain sort of ideological constructions that we then also worship with the same intensity, with the same lack of ambiguity and irony that we need to be looking at them with.
Vikram Chandra, you started Geek Sublime in order to avoid writing a novel. So where are you on your next novel?
I'm back to it. I'm very thrilled to be back to it because I don't have to make footnotes and I don't have to pay people for rights to quote things, which was discovering the rights regime when I was trying to quote medieval translations of medieval poetry was quite an education for me.
How far along are you on the new book?
Oh, it's early days. It's very hard to tell. If you had asked me 2 years ago where I was in Geek Sublime, I would have said, I'm a month away from finishing it. So I generally don't know. I'm somewhere in the middle.
One final question. Have any of your works been translated to the Bollywood screen? I know your mother's a screenwriter.
Not the works themselves, but I've worked on Bollywood films. I've been one of the main writers on a movie that was released in 2000, and I've worked as a consultant on a bunch of other projects.
You're still doing that?
I try to keep a kind of arm's length from the industry in general because I discovered very early on in my life that I'm not built for collaboration. So I'm still doing a bit of it. Sacred Games is in development as a long-form TV series. So I'm sort of, I think my official title is something like associated producer or something. I'm not writing it, but I am involved in the production part of it.
Is that American or?
It's American. I should emphasize also that, like all movie projects, it doesn't really exist until the day that they start shooting it. But yes, it's American. We're in talks with AMC, Mad Men and Breaking Bad and so forth.
You've been listening to an interview with Vikram Chandra, whose latest book is an essay titled Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.